The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Dr. Richard E. Grant has just published a fabulous memoir called A Pocket Full of Happiness. It's a book of light and shade because it was written in the time just after his wife Joan's passing. Richard E. Grant, good morning.
Morning, Pat.
Your new book, A Pocket Full of Happiness, it's a strange title, but there is a derivation which begets it.
Yes. My wife, Joan Washington, who we'd been married for 34 and a half years and together for 38, 4 days before she died in September last year, she said to my daughter and I know you're both going to be sad, obviously, but everybody has to go sometime. It's just my turn. And I charge you both to find a pocketful of happiness in each day. And at the time, it seemed so impossible to even imagine that. But in navigating the abyss of grief that we've had to deal with over the last year, it's proved an incredibly simple but clear way of trying to get the best out of every day, even in something that's very simple that you normally would have taken for granted. And the other thing about what she said that has proved so helpful is that it's given us both permission to feel joy and happiness without any guilt. So that is why it's called A Pocket Full of Happiness, because it charts our 38 years together and bounces boomerangs backwards and forwards in time through our relationship and the last 8 months of her life.
Well, the book, because it is about the slow demise of Joan, it should, in theory, be a very upsetting book, but it's not. Because you do, as you say, jump back and forward to your youth, to your young days as an actor in London, right the way through an infatuation with Barbara Streisand, which persists, I believe, to this day.
Yes, it does. Well, I think that, if you take 38 years together, the last 8 months when she was dying, relative to the 38 years, is a very small percentage. And the wonderful thing about memory is that it tricks you into remembering all the good stuff rather than the last 8 months of her life. So I'm very grateful for that, because last year, all I could see in my mind's eye was her deterioration and suffering, whereas now my memory has recalibrated and I remember her in the prime of her life, which, is very good. But the diary, which begins on the day of her diagnosis on her birthday, the 21st of December 2020, and ends on the 2nd of September 2021 when she died, means that I have, in sort of near forensic detail, every day of what that process was, so that I can't have my memory trick me into thinking whether it was better or worse or what it was. So that was the impulse to record all of it down. And yes, my obsession with Barbara Streisand is 53 years and counting.
Because you reproduce in your book the most remarkable fan letter to Barbara Streisand when you were but a 14-year-old. And
yes.
It's so mature. That's what, I have it in front of me, so I can perhaps read a little bit of it. I sincerely hope this reaches you personally. You don't know me yet, but I'm writing to offer you an idea you might like to consider. My name is Richard, and I live in a small African kingdom called Swaziland in Southeast Africa. Since seeing Funny Girl, we, my family that is, and I have been very big fans. I've followed your career avidly. We have all your records. I'm 14 years old. Now, this is the bit that I love. I read in the paper that you were feeling very tired and pressurized by your fame and failed romance with Mr. Ryan O'Neill. I would like to offer you a 2-week holiday or longer at our house, which is very beautiful, with a pool and a magnificent view of the Ezuwini Valley, which the Swazi people call Valley of Heaven. I think you'll agree that when you see it, here you can rest. No, this is another good bit. No one will trouble you, and I assure you will not be mobbed in the street, as your films only show in one cinema for 3 days, so not that many people will know who you are, so no chance of being mobbed. please consider this respite seriously. You will always be welcome. In anticipation of a hasty reply.
Yes, which took another 50 years to get via Twitter. Yep.
I was nothing if not determined, Pat. Yeah, now, the match with you and Joan was an unlikely one. I mean, you describe your arrival in the UK and, you know, your prospects were not great.
No, absolutely hopeless. You know, I arrived, I was 25 years old, I had a couple of suitcases and a box of cassettes and a Walkman, my most prized possession, and then I worked as a waiter to, you know, earn a living to pay for my bedsit rental. And then I finally got an agent, and he said, you know, you could, because of, you know, your what you look like and your very dark hair and light blue eyes, you could feasibly go up to play Irish parts because of all the troubles in Belfast and the dramas being made about that. You could feasibly audition for that. So go and get an accent, Dan. He said, how's your Belfast? And I said, debatable. And so I was then went to the Actors' Centre in Covent Garden, which you could get classes for very, very little money. And there was a woman called Joan Washington doing a series of regional accents, and that's how we met. I didn't ever get a Belfast role, but I subsequently was asked to record all the dialogue for a play that she was coaching on at the Royal Shakespeare Company, which required a Swati speaker, and because I speak the language, she asked me to come around for dinner after I'd completed my accent course at the Actors' Centre in January 1983, and I didn't go home that night. So essentially, a conversation that began in bed in January 1983 ended in bed on the 2nd of September 2021, 38 years later.
Now, she was married when you met her first, when you paid your 12 quid for a 1 hour of tuition from her. All she said, 2 hours and you'll be grand. But she did need you for this demo. But do you think that she had her eyes on you and that's why she asked you to do that task? Or was it just serendipitous dinner?
It was a genuine request, because I hadn't, after I'd finished the course in November 1982. This was then January 1983, and I'd had no contact with her in between. And she needed somebody who could speak Swati. And she said to me, you know, genuinely, you're the only person in London that I know speaks that language. I've never met anybody that does before. And in the days of pre-internet, it wasn't that you could go online and say, I need this Swati speaker now to put these lines on tape. So, you know, who knows? I don't know. She's not here to tell me, but it certainly worked out. And what I discovered when I went round to her house for dinner to record all this stuff is that her husband was living in Liverpool because he was directing a TV series that just started up called Brookside, and he was living with the makeup artist on it. So they had, they were as good as divorced.
And that began a romance which lasted all of those more than three decades, almost four. I mean, she took a look at you, bag of bones.
She did. She said, when I got into bed, she said, she said, you're like a bloody stick insect. And, which is not the opening line that you want in terms of seduction if you're on the skinny side of things. But, I, as I've said before, I'm very persistent. So, obviously I did something right.
Now, the two of you were, like peas in a pod, to use one metaphor, but like chalk and cheese in other ways. You say that she was utterly private until, her illness, and then she was persuaded to welcome the attention of friends as the information was passed on that she had a very serious illness. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, I mean, she would be private, whereas you would be out
public.
There.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, she was, she was essentially backstage because she coached actors to do accents. So she wanted her job to be as invisible as possible so that the actor shone, which is not to say that she was shy or self-effacing in real life. She was very provocative and funny and asked 1,000 questions a minute. So, but she balked at kind of publicity and all that stuff. So, which is why she really shocked me when she said, you know, I love you, Suarez, but I'm not coming to the Oscars. You know, go with our daughter instead, because I'm 5'3" and I don't want to be, you know, pushed around by Amazonian women in gigantic heels who, you know, only want to speak to you. And so I was very angry at the time. And then my daughter did a Kofi Annan and diplomatically said, you know, I think that she is right. And so it proved to be, especially when I got to meet Barbara Streisand. She said, I'm so glad that Mum is not here to see you slavering all over the place.
Recently, I saw on one of the streaming channels a movie that I hadn't seen before. I was looking to be entertained without, you know, too many demands on me. And I watched The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, in which you feature. I laughed and laughed out loud, and I was wondering, you know, how much of you is that man?
Well, thank you. I think I'm in it for about 4.5 nanoseconds. I am not a drug addict, and I played somebody completely manic and, you know, having taken 0.5 kilo of cocaine. So I think that's called acting, Pat, but thank you very much for the compliment.
No, it's just, it is short, but it's hilarious. But going back to your first break, you know, with Neil and I, although you had trod the boards in theatre before that, with Neil and I, it was literally typecasting.
Yeah, typecasting in that that I'm an alcoholic, you mean? No, I'm allergic to alcohol.
An out-of-work actor struggling to make his way.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Bullseye accurate. I'd been out of work for 9 months before that. So when I got that part, and the casting director, Mary Selway, said to me, have you spent any time being unemployed? And I said, yes, the last 9 months. And she said, oh, well, that's very good, because this character that you're reading for has been unemployed for most of the last 10 years, so it was the perfect segue. It made up for all the suffering and anguish of those 9 months, wondering whether I would ever get a job. But, you know, these things are sliding doors of good luck, because if Daniel Day-Lewis hadn't turned down the part, because he'd opened in Room of the View and My Beautiful Laundrette simultaneously in the USA, so he was an overnight discovery, and got offered everything in sight. So mercifully for me, he went off to do The Unbearable Lightness of Being instead, so which meant that, you know, it was open sesame for whoever could go up for this part, and I was just lucky enough to have got it. I know that any actor playing or, you know, saying those Whisnell lines would have, you know, had a career, you know, launch from that, because the script is, you know, solid gold.
Well, you know, Daniel is such a great method actor that he probably would have had to have been out of work for several months before he attempted the part.
Yes, and be in rehab now.
Now, a lot of your book, as I say, is hugely entertaining, but underlying the whole thing is the narrative of Joan's illness, which was a bit of an ambush, because a shortness of breath and then some disorientation and ultimately a diagnosis, which was a serial diagnosis. The bad news didn't come all in one fell swoop, and it was leavened by good news along the way. Yeah. But what a journey you had.
Yes, in that there was no pre... You know, that's the stealth of lung cancer, is that I think 99% of people only find out once they've got stage four, when it's too late. So she had a slight shortness of breath for a week beforehand, before she was diagnosed, and said, you know, I think I should just go and see the doctor because of COVID and lockdown, Christmas and New Year coming. So we went and had a lung x-ray, and then within 3 days, we were told she had 12 to 18 months, at best. And it literally was like a bomb going off. And she was put on an experimental new American drug only available there, that halved the tumors in 2 weeks. And, you know, because I'm very glass three quarters full, I thought, well, maybe she's going to be the one person out of the 160 people so far that this drug is going to carry on reducing it and take it away completely. But it plateaued, and it then stopped working after 3 months. So, yeah.
And of course, there were side effects along the way where her lung became detached because of that treatment, and oxygen was trapped. And I mean, there's quite a detailed medical description of all she was going through. Mm-hmm. In the course of that illness, which you knew from fairly early on yourself and Oily knew this was going to be terminal, you still managed to find some good times.
Yes, because, you know, when you're, my immediate thought when we got the diagnosis was, if they said 12 to 18 months, I thought, oh, well, we'll have a Valentine, we'll get to our next wedding anniversary, the 35th, we'll have her birthday, we'll have another Christmas, hopefully. So immediately I pegged onto those posts of hope, if you like. But when, after 3 months, this drug just stopped working, and we knew that she had, you know, 3 or 4 months at best, you have to say and do everything that you'd wanted to. And the great privilege of that is that, you know, my daughter's best friend's father dropped dead of a heart attack, and all they'd done in the morning is say, you know, bye, Dad, and then that was it. So we had all this time, we had those 8 months to stay and be together in a way that was so intense and loving. And joyful as well. And, you know, the response that we got from our friends was absolutely extraordinary. So those are the positives. And, of course, you know, we were relieved for her when she did die so that she didn't have to struggle any longer. And then, of course, your own grief really begins because you're just left with this vacuum. As even though you know that it's coming, nothing, I don't think, prepares you for that, just never ever being able to touch or talk to that person ever again. But I've reconfigured that in my head because, having been together for almost 4 decades, I know what her response to things would be. So, you know, I don't believe in an afterlife, but I have an ongoing conversation with her in my head.
There are so many stories in the book, visiting with King Charles, now King Charles, and Camilla. And you have, unfortunately, a scarred bottom, a bloody bottom from a particular movie experience. It is one of the funniest stories. I'm not going to spoil it by asking you to tell it, just to tease our listeners with that story. It is hilarious. Anyway, look, Richard, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. I've loved your book, absolutely.
Thank you.
It's a memoir which goes back to the very beginning and an incident with your mother when you were 6 years old, which, again, I won't spoil for our listeners. But it is called A Pocketful of Happiness, and it's out now. It's published by Gallery Books UK. And Richard E. Grant, thank you so much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.